Hi there, welcome to the Championship Rounds, a new podcast talking about the biggest show in mixed martial arts, the UFC. My name's Simon Head, I'm an MMA journalist for BT Sport, and joining me on the other end of the line is MMA journalist Ralph Welch. How are you, mate?
I'm very well, thanks, Simon. It's good to be here talking to you from the mean streets of East London. Looking forward to talking UFC.
Yeah, we've got five rounds, just as you would get in a championship fight. So five rounds basically means we're going to have five big questions that we've got either leading into a big event or responding to a big event. Recording this in the wake of UFC Fight Night 57 in Austin, Texas. The majority of these rounds we'll be talking about the big talking points that have come from that event. So let's kick things straight off with round number one and question number one. After Frankie Edgar's performance against Cub Swanson, who do you think should get the next shot at the UFC featherweight title, Ralph?
Well, this is a question that's been a subject of, you know, a hell of a lot of debate on social media, on websites. We've seen tons of column inches devoted to it. I think it really depends on your outlook, to be honest, Simon. I think you have to think about it like this. If your job is to find out who is the best fighter in the world at 145 pounds, then there is an excellent case that Frankie Edgar deserves that title shot. You put it into perspective, he's just given Cub Swanson an absolute drubbing, a real shellacking. It was totally one-sided. So from that point of view, from a pure sports point of view, Frankie Edgar should get that shot. Having said that, if your job is to sell as many tickets as you can, if your job is to sell as many pay-per-views as you can, and if your job is to get as many new eyeballs on your product as you can, then Conor McGregor gets that title shot without question. How do you feel about that?
I completely agree with you. And I also think that I've seen a lot of people, including some of the top contenders in the division, and even people who aren't even in the weight division. Matt Brown was quite vocal yesterday, basically said, What the hell? I'm cleaning this up as well. What the hell has Conor McGregor done to deserve a title shot? Frankie Edgar more than deserves his shot at the title. Now, far be it from me to argue from my ivory tower here, where I don't actually get to step in the octagon and fight. But I don't think Matt Brown's talking sense. Let me explain why. Frankie Edgar's had his shot at the title, and he lost. He had that shot on the back of two losses. He lost back-to-back fights to Benson Henderson in another weight division. They moved him down to featherweight, and they gave him a title shot. Let's take a look at the other people who have been vocal about Conor McGregor potentially getting a title shot. Ricardo Lamas. Ricardo Lamas has had his shot at the title and he lost. How did he earn that title shot? Let's have a look at how these guys earned their title shot. He beat Cub Swanson, who at the time had gone 2-2 in his previous four fights. He fought Hatsu Hioki, who's done nothing since. He's lost four of his last five, I think. He beat Eric Koch, who's done nothing since. Koch also lost to Dustin Poirier, who we know McGregor beat him. So Lamas didn't do anything particularly outstanding. He earned a title shot off the back of that body of work. Look at Chad Mendes. He only had two fights in the UFC before he got his first crack at Jose Aldo. Both of those were decision wins over Michihiro Omigawa and Rani Yaya. Now, if Conor McGregor had come into the UFC and picked up decision wins against Omigawa and Yaya and started calling for a title shot, he'd have been laughed out of the building, wouldn't he?
Absolutely he would.
You know? So it's one of the... Mendes had his title shot. He's obviously his second title shot. He went on an incredible run of fights. All credit to him. He really did everything he needed to do to earn that title shot second time round, and he came up short again in a very, very good performance. Frankie Edgar. What's Frankie Edgar done at featherweight? Let's look at what he's done at featherweight. His first fight in the featherweight division was a title fight to Jose Aldo, which he lost. Since then, he's beaten Charles Oliveira by decision. Swanson knocked out Oliveira in a round. And he TKO'd BJ Penn, who really shouldn't have been fighting. So other than his performance against Swanson this weekend, you could argue that really Edgar's only won one fight of any significance in the featherweight division. You then look at McGregor. Okay, Marcus Brimage was a good opening bout for him. Max Holloway is one of the most informed fighters in the UFC right now, and McGregor beat him with one leg.
Absolutely.
He beat Brandao, who's a dangerous fighter in the first round. He stopped him in the first round. Dustin Poirier, a lot of people were talking about him as being the guy who's going to expose Conor McGregor. McGregor did for him in the first round. So if you look at how those guys all earned their title shot first time round, you could argue they've actually had an easier run to their title shots than McGregor. And McGregor still has to get past Dennis Siver as well. So I think it's all a little bit smoke and mirrors, to be honest. I think these guys have had their shot at the title, and what they did to earn their shot at the title is comparable, and I think not as strong as what McGregor's done in the featherweight division. You know, Edgar's a little bit different because he came down from another weight division, but you can't hide the fact that you don't get many people earn a title shot in any division on the back of two defeats, but Edgar did. I think McGregor is absolutely nailed on to get this title shot.
And do you think, Simon, because the way you've spoken about it there, you've looked at it very much from a merit point of view, what these guys have done or perhaps not done in the octagon once the bell goes to earn their title shots, to earn their rise up the rankings. I think there's a bigger kind of question here, because everybody is lamenting the lack of star power in the UFC in 2014. Silva's gone, he's on his way back. Diaz was gone, he's on his way back. GSP's gone. They've taken a huge hit at the box office. We've been decimated by injuries. Business, you know, not doing quite as well as perhaps they were hoping, according to recent reports. Not as much money in the coffers. They need something. And if you're in the UFC and you've got someone as red hot on social media, you know, in person, a ticket seller like Conor McGregor, then you light the beacon. You get that guy on the top of the docket, you get him on the top of the billboard, and you strike while the iron's hot. Because I think we all assume, most likely, he'll dismiss Dennis Siver and get the job done in Boston. The next step, the most logical step, from a profitability point of view, and probably from the point of view of what will get most eyeballs on your product, it just has to be McGregor. I don't see any other argument for this, because this is also about show. It's about a spectacle. And Conor McGregor will guarantee a spectacle like no other on the UFC roster at this moment.
I completely agree with that. I mean, I remember when the UFC first started, it was which style is the best? That's why it was created. Which fighting style is the best? That now has gone out the window. And it's all about now who's the best fighter in the world, and we want to put on the best fights that the fans want to see. Now, the argument against McGregor that we're hearing is that he hasn't demonstrated that he's good enough yet. That's why I was coming at it from the way I was coming at it. But look at what the other guys did to earn their title shots first time round. McGregor's more than matched that. If you took a poll, who would you rather see fight Jose Aldo next? Would people pick Ricardo Lamas over Conor McGregor? I don't think many would. Good as Ricardo Lamas undoubtedly is, would people pick Frankie Edgar? The other thing with McGregor here is, let's look at this with a very cynical set of spectacles on for a minute. And let's say that Conor McGregor is going to be exposed by a wrestler when he eventually comes up against one. I'm not convinced that he will be. But let's just say for a minute that he is, right? Let's say he won't be able to deal with someone like a Chad Mendes. If we put him in with someone like a Chad Mendes now, and Mendes beats him, that money-spinning opportunity to stick him in a major, major world title match potentially goes out the window. So if you're looking at it from the UFC, you have to assume that all things are possible and that all things could happen. So if McGregor fights a wrestler and loses, they may have shot their golden goose before they get a chance to actually get anything out of it. Put him in a title shot. He'd be stylistically very well suited to fight Jose Aldo. I think it would be a good fight. Win, lose or draw, I think it will raise his stock further. And then put him in with the likes of Mendes. Put him in with the likes of Edgar and Lamas. You know, Joe Silva and Sean Shelby have an unenviable task here. They have to manage the career path of all these individual fighters. But you've also got to do what's best for business. And what's best for business, as you said, is to stick McGregor in. If he gets past Dennis Siver, stick him in with Jose Aldo in sort of June, July in Dublin. Give him that massive event that the UFC knows will be a huge success. And even if McGregor doesn't win that fight, the event will be a massive success. It'll be a 50,000-60,000 gate. It'll be an incredible financial success for them. And it also strengthens the UFC's footing in Europe even more. So I think it's an absolute no-brainer. Frankie Edgar's not going anywhere. Frankie Edgar will be a contender in 6 months' time, no problem whatsoever. So I don't see an issue with making him wait. You can give him another fight, and I still think he'll be a contender. So I think McGregor is absolutely the right choice. And the thing that I just took exception to was people sort of dismissing McGregor far too easily on the strength of what he's done so far, given what the other fighters had done to earn their title shots.
Yeah, and I think the one thing I'd add to that is that some of the names I see that are criticising McGregor, and those are names of fighters, I think there's an element, not necessarily just of jealousy, but I don't think these fighters actually understand the work that McGregor has done, not only physically and mentally to get to where he is in the game at this moment, but from a marketability point of view. I think McGregor understands that this is a show business spectacle now. And the work that he's done on social media, the work that he does every single time a microphone is in front of him to engage with the crowd, whether they love him, whether they hate him, they invest in him personally, so that the next time he's got a pair of gloves on and the cage door closes, they want to see McGregor fight because they want to see him win or they want to see him lose terribly. That's what he's done better than anybody else. That's why I think we're both in agreement. He should get that title shot, and Frankie Edgar's just going to have to wait in line.
When we look at the co-main event from Saturday night, Edson Barboza defeated Bobby Green in the co-main event in Austin. Is Barboza now starting to finally fulfill his potential at the UFC?
Well, I mean, you look at his record in the UFC. I mean, when he's been on octagon duty, he's now on 9-2. He's got wins now over the King, Bobby Green, Evan Dunham, Danny Castillo. These are all very decent names on your resume. And he's also got, you know, some highlight reel stuff there. You know, if you're putting together 30 seconds of footage of Edson Barboza, that's about six fights worth, because he's got this lethal ability to rob people of their senses. I mean, that Terry Ettin knockout will probably stay with me for the rest of my days. It was one of the most extraordinary things I think I've seen in the octagon. So I do think he's fulfilling his potential from a physical point of view, from the point of view as a competitor and a genuine force in the division. But I guess just going back to where we left that, the first point was my question about Edson Barboza is, what do we know about him? What has he given us emotionally to kind of invest in him as a personality? Have we done it? Is there enough about the other side of him, away from the incredible ability and athleticism, is there enough to take him up to that very, very top level and make him the star that perhaps his talents deserve? Because I'm not convinced right at this moment. It reminds me a little bit of Henan Barao. Actually, you know, Henan Barao, the UFC really pushed as a monster, and he, you know, phenomenal run, phenomenal record, outstanding ability. But he really didn't engage with the masses. Now, that was in part, it was an English language problem. It is hard to engage with someone who speaks exclusively through an interpreter, which Barboza doesn't. But there was still a kind of disconnect, a gap there. And I think what these guys have got to think about, and it's hard to do it because they're in a grind, you know, 12 weeks of camp, thinking non-stop about getting themselves ready for this next big challenge, which could move them up the rankings. But there is that other element to this. And with Edson Barboza, what I would say is, fantastic athlete. If he's on the telly, I'm watching it. He is incredible. He's guaranteed entertainment. I love his fighting style. But when I think about where he's going to go next, or where his ceiling is within the rankings of the UFC, within that hierarchy, I think we're going to have to learn a bit more about him. I think he's going to have to give us more to invest in him more as a personality and as a fighter.
It's a bit of an obscure reference for anybody who's listening to this who isn't that up to speed with English soccer. And I'll say soccer because if anyone in America's listening to this, I see Edson Barboza as the John Barnes of the UFC. And let me explain what I mean by this. For those out there who aren't familiar with the name of John Barnes, He was an English footballer who played back in the 80s. Incredibly powerful player. Superb. On his day, one of the best players in Europe. Possibly one of the best players in the world. He had great skill, power, talent. But his career was dogged by one moment that happened quite early on in his career. He played against Brazil in the Maracanã Stadium in front of about 150,000 fans and proceeded to take on the entire Brazilian side, beat about 8 players and scored probably the best goal ever scored by an English player in an international match. And unfortunately, the reputation of that goal sort of hung around his neck like a millstone from that point on, as people just expected him to reproduce that sort of magic every time he stepped onto the pitch. That was a once-in-a-lifetime piece of skill that he produced. I think there's a little bit of that with Barbosa. I think Barbosa, he's got that incredible highlight reel KO of Terry Ettim, and you can see him trying to reproduce it fight on fight on fight. And he's incredibly talented. He's got all the skill in the world when it comes to striking. He's one of the most spectacular strikers in the game. But people, I think, are always looking back at that one KO, and it's hard for him to progress past that. If that knockout had come in a number one contender fight or in a title fight, we'd be looking at a major league superstar right now. But it came in a mid-card fight quite early on in his UFC career. And I think that may be causing him a bit of an issue, in as much as people are almost expecting him to produce that every time he steps into the octagon. And that's an unrealistic expectation. He's lost a couple of fights, but they were both really exciting fights that he lost, Jamie Varner and Donald Cerrone. But his performances in general have been good. I think I just think that because they haven't been as eye-poppingly spectacular as that finish of Ettim, perhaps that may have held him back a little bit. I completely take your point about the marketability side of things. His English is pretty good. He was conducting Octagon interviews in English. I don't think he's got any problem pushing himself out there from a marketing perspective. It was interesting in the post-fight press conference. It's the first bit of real personality I think we've seen from him, where he was saying, "You haven't seen the best of me yet, but you know you will do soon." And you can see that he almost feels like he's turned a corner, I think, with that victory on Saturday. I mean, I picked him to lose that fight, but that doesn't mean anything. I picked all three of the top fights wrong. So, I honestly thought Bobby Green would have a bit too much for him. I thought he'd be a bit too varied for Barbosa, but no, Barbosa outperformed him, did very well. He seems to be developing his game. He seems a lot more streetwise now inside the octagon than perhaps he was when Jamie Varner overwhelmed him. And he looks a proper contender now. The problem you've got, of course, is that he's in the lightweight division, which is an absolute murderer's row. It's such a tough division, and it's very congested at the top. There's not a lot in the way of opportunity ahead of him. He needs to be fighting people above him now. I think the best option for him is to give him the winner of the Rafael Dos Anjos-Nate Diaz fight. And if he wins that, then you're in a position where maybe he can fight for a title shot. But I do agree. I think learning a bit more about some of these guys, and we were talking about this before we went on air with the podcast. We were talking about how important it is, especially over here in Europe, to build stars and help educate people as to who these people are, as well as showing them their skill and ability actually in the octagon. If we give people the stories of these fighters and actually let people into their lives a little bit and show them actually who these people are, then people will buy into them much more readily, whether they're newbie fans or whether they're existing fans who've been watching the sport for ages, but all of a sudden they can connect more with an individual fighter, and they'll sort of latch onto that, and fighters' fan bases will grow as a result of that. And I think, as you say, I think that's something that would do Edson Barbosa no harm at all.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the fault on that doesn't necessarily lie with Edson Barbosa. I mean, that is a common issue, I think, across the UFC roster at the moment. And there are different reasons for that, as we said off air. I mean, the schedule is very, very tough. Goodness knows if or how Joe Silver or Sean Shelby sleep at night trying to put this incredible puzzle together of who's going where and who's filling what cards. But just from a media point of view, when you're trying to build these fights up, give them the spotlight that these athletes deserve, it's very, very difficult now, because pretty much as soon as you press send on your email and that fight report's been filed, you've got to move on. You've got to think about what's coming in the next 7 days, because there could be two events. And which means that whereas 4 years ago, or when you first started watching this sport or whatever, or when you first started covering it, you had time. You could do plenty of build-up on Edson Barboza. You could introduce the fan base to him, whether that's through video, whether that's through copy on your site. And then afterwards, you could reflect a bit on Barboza. How did he do? Where does he go next, etc.? You just haven't got time. So these guys, unless they are red hot, unless they're lightning in a bottle like McGregor is, they're just getting lost in the shuffle a bit amid this incredibly packed UFC schedule. So I don't want that to sound like I'm pointing my finger at Barboza and saying he has to do more. It's an issue across the whole sport. I think the one thing I would say about Barboza is he is a hell of an asset to the UFC. I love the John Barnes reference you've made there. But even in those fights that he lost to Cerrone and Varner, I mean, they were great scraps, real feisty scraps. So where he is at the moment, he's a big, big asset to the UFC. I think you can put him first, second fight on a pay-per-view and no one's going to complain about that, and people are going to tune in and watch him. It's just a question of where he goes next.
And something that I think you might start to see the UFC doing as they roll out more events in Europe, and you start to see the top of these weight divisions get more and more congested. We're seeing it at featherweight in particular now. Lightweight's got a similar problem. These guys are going to struggle to find spots in co-mains and main events, I think, in America. So what we'll find is these guys will be farmed out to Brazil, they'll be farmed out to Europe, which I think is great for the growth of the sport. I mean, how great would it be to see someone like Edson Barboza in a lightweight co-main event over here in Europe? For fans to see someone of that technical skill coming over, and I think hopefully it will just help spread the sport even more. I think, you know, the one accusation that's been leveled in the past is that it tends to be very North American centric. And it was interesting what Gary Cook said on the MMA Hour yesterday. He said that the UFC now is not an American based sports organization looking to push their product into other countries. They now see themselves as a global sports organization managing a global calendar of events. And while obviously that's a very good thing to say from a PR point of view, if that really is the view that they're taking, then hopefully we'll see a bigger spread of talent across the world and in Europe, down in Australia, in Brazil. I mean, Brazil are pretty well served as it is, to be fair. But particularly on our side of the pond, hopefully we'll get to see bigger fights, bigger matchups. And, you know, maybe people like Barboza would benefit from something like that, where getting them into the European office here in London, where perhaps we have got a bit more time to start to talk to the guys and build them up a bit more, whereas perhaps in Vegas there is a bit more of an event to event churn. So maybe, you know, maybe that's one solution to it. It might help build things up a bit more, but it'd be interesting to see what happens with him in the future. When I wrote this question down, I thought to myself, I have no idea how I'm going to answer this, but I wrote it down anyway. British fighters Brad Pickett and Luke Barnett both fell to back-to-back defeats at UFC Fight Night Austin. Pickett lost to Chico Camus. Barnett lost to Roger Narvaez. Is British MMA at the elite level on the decline?
I thought about this question. My first reaction was, well, you've just quoted two guys there, two straight losses each. Your knee-jerk reaction is, yes, it is. But I think that's a really sweeping statement to say British MMA at that elite level is necessarily on a decline. Because for every Pickett and Barnett that are having some tricky times at the moment, there's a McGregor who's just flying. Or there's, at the lower level, there's a Carl Pendred who's progressing very nicely in his career to date. So I think rather than look at it as a whole, you know, as the British MMA scene in general, I think you've got to still stick to individuals and their stories. So if we take the individuals, let's think about Brad Pickett. You know, and there's no doubt about it, these are tough times for Brad Pickett. I think the experiment of moving to flyweight was absolutely worth trying, because he found himself in a little bit of a tailspin at 135. But we look at it now, and ultimately, you have to say, and I'm sure he's looking at it with his team, it's been a failure so far. I've seen him at every weigh-in since he moved down to the 125 pounds, and my goodness, he looks skeletal when he steps on the scales. When he stepped on there in London, I was on the brink of calling Bob Geldof. Honestly, he looked terrible. It was frightening. And I think, generally, when you try and make that drop down a weight class, you're hoping that you retain that little bit of extra power. Something's going to be a little bit of a difference maker. But when you go down as low as 125 pounds, the problem is it's speed, not power, that makes a difference there. So I think over the next few weeks, if Brad Pickett's going to have a decision to make about where he goes next, personally, I wouldn't be surprised to see him go back up to 135 pounds. Because the one thing we know about Brad, he does have a connect with the fans. People like him. He's got a great personality. He can talk a bit in front of a microphone. He's a funny fella. And the other good thing is that when he puts a pair of gloves on, he gives you entertainment. So personally, rather than answer that question as a whole, I think you've got to go to the individuals. I've covered Brad there. What did you think of Luke Barnett's performance?
I thought he was slightly harshly dealt with, to be honest. I think if you look at Barnett's record on paper and you say, oh, he's had back-to-back losses. But if you actually look at the fights he was in, you could make a strong argument that he won both of them. I think he's found himself in two fights where he'll probably come away thinking, I wish I'd done a little bit more. And that's not a criticism of Luke. I think he's got more in the tank. I think he's got more in the locker. Both those defeats were very, very close. I don't think it's a disaster for him. But if you lose three in the trot in the UFC, you are treading a tightrope. So it does put a certain element of pressure on his next fight. I hope for him that it results in a really spectacular performance, because he is one of the most exciting talents coming up from the UK. You talk about people trying to market themselves, people trying to do things the right way. Luke is doing everything right. I mean, he's not been too insular in his approach. He's trained out of the Tsunami Gym here in England. Once he got himself into the UFC, he decided that he needed to expand his horizons. He's now over in San Diego training with Alliance, and I think that will only benefit his game going forward. And I also think he's enlisted Mike Dolce to help him with his weight and his weight management and his diet, which I think is a good thing. He's a big, big middleweight. He's also enlisted the help of a sports psychologist, which is also, I think, a very, very good move. And you can see how it's helping him. And from a personality point of view, he's doing really well. I think he's developing himself a little bit of a niche over here as someone who could become a bit of a media personality in MMA circles. If we had a UFC Tonight type show, you could see someone like Luke Barnett sitting on the panel there and doing the sort of job that you see from Daniel Cormier or Dominic Cruz. He's got that ability, and he's got it there for him to be a success in the media and to be a success in the cage. And obviously, he's had two knockbacks with two, I would say, pretty controversial decision losses. So the big thing for him now is to get right back in there as soon as possible, get himself a win, and then kick on. From his point of view, I don't think he's in a rut at all. I don't think he's on the decline. I think he's just developing his game. He's very young in this sport. I think he'll develop into a very good middleweight. On the topic of Brad, I completely agree about moving back up to bantamweight. I think the big difference moving down to flyweight, we talked about the potential for carrying down his punch power, but the issue has been speed. And while Brad is certainly not a slow fighter, at flyweight, he isn't the fastest. He's fighting guys who are very fleet of foot, and it's proving quite difficult to lay his gloves on them at times. So I think back up at bantamweight, he'll feel stronger at the weight. I think the fighters will be much more on a level with him with regards to pace as well. So I agree with you. I think that's a move I'd definitely like to see him make in 2015. It'd be interesting to see what he does next.
Absolutely. I mean, like you said, you can't punch what you can't reach. And at the moment with these guys, the speed at 125 pounds is so phenomenal. I mean, it's like sometimes it's like watching a game of tennis, you know, really Federer and Nadal in action. Your eyes are going everywhere trying to just believe the spectacle before your eyes. I think Brad will be better served in that division. I do think your question about is British MMA on the decline is an interesting one, in a sense that it feels like, after what happened in Sweden, perhaps the European scene for our mixed martial artists isn't looking quite as rosy. We took a little bit of a shellacking that night over in Stockholm. Some people didn't perform quite as well as they would have hoped and the Swedes would have hoped. So I'm intrigued to see what happens next. We've got plenty of Brits on the card in Boston. Pendred's on the card, Holohan's on the card, along with McGregor, of course. That's going to be an incredible atmosphere there. Huge Irish contingent following. I called it UFC Dublin 2, bring the noise. I think it's going to be spectacular. And my gut feel is that in that environment, those three guys are just going to bring us back up to that level playing field and perhaps restore a little bit of parity.
Well, fingers crossed. I mean, that Boston event looks like it's going to be a fun night. It's one of those where you just wish you could be there in the arena to experience it. It's going to be a lively one, I think, UFC Fight Night Boston. But British MMA, I think, you know, we aren't dead and buried just yet. I think it'd be interesting to see how things develop. I think it's important that we still start to feed fighters through into the system. So it'd be interesting to see what happens in terms of new talent in the next 18 months or so. Who are going to be the next British guys to come in and not just fight in the UFC, but establish themselves? Let's take a look at the remainder of UFC Fight Night 57. What any other business have we got from UFC Fight Night 57?
Well, Simon, I mean, the one thing that struck me was when I watched that undercard and I watched the main card as well, I thought, who in their right mind would be a heavyweight in the UFC today? Talk about a thankless task. And let's put this in perspective. 2 weeks ago, we had Mark Hunt. Now, Mark Hunt is a bona fide Rocky story of mixed martial arts. Incredible character, incredible background. He's gone from zero to hero. He got back to the pinnacle on 3 weeks' notice to fight for Doom for the heavyweight title. It was a Cinderella Man story. And in that fight, he hit Verdun from pillar to post, dominated him for every second of every minute, until out of nowhere, Verdun hits a flying knee and he drops him on his bum. What sort of a division is that to work in? And the reason I bring it back to UFC Fight Night 57 is Jared Rosholt looked in total control of his bout against the commentator's nightmare, Alexei Oleinik. Had him up against the fence, punches, elbows, everything's flying beautifully. He's in the box seat, boom. Two punches later, it's goodnight, Irene. He's face down on the canvas and he's not getting a winner's bonus. What a division the heavyweights are. You are literally two punches away from a heavyweight title shot, because that's all it'll need to get two wins under your belt. What did you make of that fight?
I was delighted because I picked Oleinik to win, but I actually thought he would win by submission. I did not see a knockout coming, and I have to be honest, I was working on the Sunday morning, so I didn't get to watch Fight Night 57 live. I had to watch it the following day, and I watched that fight knowing who won. Now, I was watching it thinking, this can't be right. The results I've got in front of me must be wrong, because Rosholt was absolutely battering Oleinik, and I was just waiting and waiting, thinking, what's he going to hit him with here? Because he didn't look like he had anything at all. And then all of a sudden, wallop, and it was done. But that's the heavyweights. And that's also why people love watching the heavyweights. Because the fights can end on an absolute toss of a coin, just one swing of a fist, and it's all over. People love to see that. And I think it's one of the reasons why mixed martial arts is growing in popularity, and some elements of boxing aren't. The big superstar fights in boxing will always garner massive audience, and rightly so. But sometimes if you watch an undercard heavyweight fight in boxing, quite often it's horribly mismatched, or you've just got these two guys just sort of slugging away at each other for sort of six rounds or whatever. You don't get that explosiveness and that fight ending wow moment that you get in the UFC. Put those small gloves on big guys and crazy things happen. And that's one of the things we saw on Saturday night. It was incredible.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing that I had as a takeaway from Fight Night 57 was I think we got a little glimpse of the future for women's mixed martial arts. And I'm talking about Paige VanZant, because she's a 20-year-old former fashion model fighting at 115 pounds. I thought she kind of stole the show a little bit, I have to be honest there, because at the moment, women's MMA, we're in a slightly odd position at the moment. We all know that Ronda Rousey's been seduced by the sort of glitter and glamour of Hollywood. We know that she's pretty much on her way. I'm not even sure if she's got one more fight. Who even knows if she'll fight again after that? The Cyborg one doesn't look like it's happening. So we're in a space where we're thinking, who's going to step up? Who's going to be that person in women's mixed martial arts to step into the mainstream the way that Rousey's done, who's done all the front covers, who's being interviewed for lifestyle magazines, who's on TMZ? And I think in Paige VanZant, you know, a former model, a cheerleader, who looks tremendous in the octagon in terms of her own ability, you know, really, really impressive performance event against Kaylin Curran, getting that third round TKO. I think we might have just seen the start of something special there. What did you think?
Her performance on Saturday was outstanding. I think, you know, it really does augur well for the future for her. I think looking at the bigger picture, the UFC's strawweight division for the women, I think is going to be a really, really big addition when it actually comes in full at the end of the Ultimate Fighter 20. If you look at the women's bantamweight division, you've basically got Ronda, then you've got Kat Zingano, and then you've got a bit of a gap between them and the rest. It isn't the most competitive division in terms of generating championship challenges. If you look at the Ultimate Fighter, just looking at the Ultimate Fighter, just from watching it, you can almost make your own little favourite matchups just from watching the series. You know, you've got a little bit of everything in there. You've got skilled submission artists. You've got really strong wrestlers. You've got excellent kickboxing. And you've also got one or two people in there who aren't afraid to open their mouth and getting people to look at them for the things that they're saying. I mean, Angela Magana may have lost her fight in the UFC, but she's certainly doing her best to make sure she doesn't get forgotten about. So you throw all of that into the mix and you've got a nice ready-made division there. Chuck Paige VanZant into the mix as well. I think you've got a really good division there. You can just plonk that straight into the UFC structure. And any fight involving two girls from that group is going to be an exciting fight. Justine Kish, unfortunately, didn't get to fight because she blew her knee out. I think she would have been a major, major contender for the overall title. So she'll come back as well. So I think it's going to be really, really fun division once that division gets ported into the UFC. And Paige VanZant will be front and centre in that. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I would say the one thing about it was actually her age that stopped her going into the Ultimate Fighter house, because she's only 20 years old. But I don't think that's done her any harm, not being in the house, because it's actually given her own profile. Whereas, like you say, the rest of those girls, they're building their feuds, they're building their rivalries, maybe even building their own allegiances. But Paige VanZant, by getting a debut away from the house, has been given her own little bit of the spotlight, and I thought she grabbed it brilliantly.
She did. Something else I spotted from Fight Night 57, Nick Hein, German lightweight fighter, very, very funny guy. Very, very funny guy. We've had him in at BT. I think he's in the wrong weight class. He fought James Vick, who is probably the tallest 155-pound fighter in the UFC, which didn't do him any favours in terms of how it looked on the television. But I just think Nick Hein would be a very strong 145er. He's only 5'8", and he's quite solid at 155. I don't think it would be an enormous job for him to cut an extra 10 pounds. And I think with his judo background and his core strength, and he's got a decent set of hands on him as well. He's got decent punch power. I think if he carries that down to 145 pounds, I think he'll have a fair bit more success. I thought he did okay against James Vick. Obviously, the decision didn't go his way. He just couldn't get in range often enough. Vick was able to keep him on the end of his jabs and kicks for a lot of the fight, and was able to dictate the distance. Such was the size difference between the two. But I think Hein at 5'8", would make a very strong featherweight if he could cut those extra 10 pounds. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, when I saw that fight, it was a bit like watching Scrappy do, right, try and put his fists up and sort of get at Uncle Scooby. It was a mismatch. In fairness to Hyde, you know, he landed some very good shots. He knocked him to the canvas on two occasions, didn't he? Yep, yep. So I completely agree. I do like his personality, and that's one thing we've already said the UFC needs is more personalities. I don't think it's going to do him any harm at all, provided he can do it. And provided he doesn't leave his best stuff in the sauna, drop the weight class, try and make something happen.
Here's something else for you. I don't know how the UFC schedule their fights, how they decide where fighters go on the fight card. Because I found it a bit strange in Austin. You had two flyweight fights on that main card. One of them was Joseph Benavidez, who's the number 2 ranked flyweight in the world. And Dustin Ortiz, who's number 13 and no slouch himself. They were two fights lower on the card than Brad Pickett versus Chico Camus. Pickett was ranked 11th going into that fight, and Camus was making his divisional debut. Yet they were pushed higher up the card. Now, if that fight was happening in Europe, I could understand it, because Pickett's got the local support. But I found that interesting, that the number 2 guy in the world was pushed a couple of fights further down the card with a lower ranked flyweight bout higher up the card. I don't know what you thought about that.
Yeah, it didn't make a huge amount of sense, because, you know, Joe Benavidez has got good pedigree, and Brad Pickett was in a bit of an odd spot in terms of his own career. Listen, we're not in a position to really try and, it's hard for us to empathise with Joe Silver and Sean Shelby, because they've probably got, in some respects, the best job in mixed martial arts and quite possibly the worst job in mixed martial arts. The one thing I'd say is, Joe Benavidez, you heard him afterwards, and I was a bit surprised at what he said after the fight. He said, you know, I'm the number 2 in the world. It doesn't make sense to call anybody out. And I thought, well, what else are you going to do? Mm. The microphone's in your face. You've just dropped down the card. And really, you didn't deserve to drop down the card. You've got yourself a hard-fought win. Call somebody out. Start something. Otherwise, you're just going to find yourself caught in a shuffle. So there was card placement, which was a bit odd as well, but I wasn't convinced that Joe Benavidez did himself any favours afterwards either.
No, it's one of my pet peeves, actually. Fighters who get the microphone and say, oh, I'll fight whoever the UFC put in front of me. Of course you are. That's your job. You know, that's a given. Tell us who you want to fight. Every fighter out there, they know what they want. So why not say? I just don't understand it when fighters have that opportunity. They're given very, very rare opportunities to do that on such a big platform. They can do it in interviews and all the rest of it, which can get picked up. But when you've got a captive audience there, you've got everyone watching you on television, you've got everyone watching you in the arena, and you've just won, they give you the microphone, and you just say, oh, I'll fight whoever they put in front of me. It's just like saying, I don't care. Now, I know that's not the case. That can't be the case. So call someone out, call anyone out. Just, as you say, make something happen. Give people something to take away as well as your performance. It's like, oh, right, Joe Benavidez did this. He wants John Dodson next. Or Joe Benavidez did this. He wants another title shot next. And you need to put that out there, because if you don't, that's how you get forgotten. If you've got a wishy-washy approach to your own self-promotion, people are going to eventually have a wishy-washy approach to you. Charles Sonnen knew exactly how to play that system. He knew that in order to get notice and to get the big money fights, he had to be himself with the volume turned up to 11. And every time he picked up the microphone, he said something worthwhile. He said something that people were talking about at the water cooler the next day. And yeah, he prepared the stuff he said. He knew what he was going to do. He knew what he was going to say. And he made a very, very successful career out of it until he got busted for drugs. But in terms of self-promotion, that's exactly what you've got to do. I think Jim Ross commented on it a while back. As well as a fighter, you're also a salesman. You've got to sell yourself. The UFC have got, I don't know how many fighters, they've probably got 400 or 500 fighters on their books. How are you going to stand out? And you can stand out through two ways. One is your ability to fight inside the octagon. But you're in the, you know, you're in a promotion where the best fighters in the world are operating. So you could be fantastic, but you're still going to be one of a group. So how are you going to step out from them? And that's when the microphone time comes in. And, yeah, Joe Benavidez is an excellent fighter. I mean, you know, he's got personality. I found it strange. If I was him, I would be absolutely gunning for either John Dodson or Demetrius Johnson. I think absolute no-brainer. But that's not criticizing him specifically. I think it's a general thing that a lot of fighters do. And if they actually had to sit down with someone like a Jim Ross, or pro wrestling gets sneered at sometimes by some of the sports purists, if you like. But I think the fighters could take a little bit from pro wrestling in terms of the way that people actually push themselves and promote themselves. And it can only help their game. If it doesn't necessarily always get them the fights they're asking for, it'll help build their personality, and they'll get more sponsors, and they'll earn more income, and they'll get put on cards more often. So it just seems like a no-brainer to me.
Absolutely. And just to wrap this one up, if you want a great example of what being good on a microphone and making people invest in you personally can do for your career, look at Tito Ortiz. Look at what happened 2 weeks ago when Bellator put on their show Ortiz against Stefan Bonner. How many times have we written off Tito Ortiz? I mean, even over in the US media, they were laughing when they announced that fight. Everyone said, you know, Scott Coker's putting on a circus. They did 2 million views.
Yep.
2 million people knew enough about Tito Ortiz, who is well past his sell-by date. Those glory days are long, long behind him. He's barely picked up a win in 6 or 7 years, and he's still making big money because people care about Tito Ortiz. They know who he is. They know they either want to see him win or they want to see him lose. And what these guys need to do is they need to learn from some of that older generation that paved the way for where the UFC is now.
Spot on. And I think Luke Thomas mentioned it. It might have been on the MMA beat, or it might just have been on his live chat. While the mixed martial arts media were thinking, you know, why should we care about Tito Ortiz anymore? The television viewership told them otherwise. Even though people, as you say, you look at his record and you think, what's he done lately? You know, his career has gone off the edge of a cliff, so to speak. From a performance point of view, he still pulls in the punters. And if you can pull in the punters, you're still very much a factor in the sport. And you can't argue with 2 million viewers. I mean, that's outstanding. So, yeah, absolutely. Get out there, promote yourself. And people should work on their promotion almost as much as they should work on their training, arguably, because it's as important a part of your overall package, I think. But we'll see. I think, you know, you can see those people at the top of the game. They all know what to do. The guys at the very top know what they're doing. And if you want to break into the upper echelon, I think you've got to be a good fighter, but you've also got to be a good promoter as well. The UFC announced their 2015 calendar last week. A lot of people turned up looking for a special announcement. It was a very special announcement. It was flagged up as. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. Dana White said they couldn't get the deal done, which I found very interesting. What's your best guess, Ralph? What do you think it is? I've got my suspicions, but what do you think that special announcement could have been?
Well, there's been a lot of different rumours about it, but let me first of all tell you, Simon, what it wasn't. And it absolutely was not, and I can almost guarantee this, it was not Brock Lesnar. And it is, what a crazy world we live in, where here we are, November 2014, we're still talking about Brock Lesnar. He's still commanding more clicks than anyone else on Google searches when it comes to MMA. It was not Brock Lesnar's comeback, despite what anyone wants. And there's a really clear reason for that. Brock Lesnar's contract with WWE, as everybody knows, ends on the 31st of March 2015. He has got 4 whole months to do what Brock Lesnar does best. And what Brock does best is he leverages people against each other. How much am I worth to you, Dana? How much am I worth to you, Vince? Let's talk about it. Let's see if we can bump that price up. He would be a fool, and he's not a fool. He's a very, very savvy businessman with a very good team around him to suddenly sign a contract 4 months in when he isn't in the best position. He will be negotiating right up to the very last minute to make sure he can extract every single dollar from every single minute of negotiation. So I'm sorry, it wasn't Brock Lesnar. That wasn't the announcement.
So what was it then?
I thought you might ask me that. I'll tell you what I thought it was. I thought it was going to be a sponsor. I don't think it was going to be an amazing announcement of a fight. I don't think we were going to get Lesnar Fedor in 2015. That wasn't going to happen. My gut feel is it may have been commercially a very, very special announcement, and we may have been talking about what would have been a very lucrative sponsorship arrangement. That's what I think, because realistically, if it was a talent, who is there out there? I've just said it wasn't Lesnar.
GSP is the only other one you could throw in there.
Exactly, and we know that GSP has been pictured fine dining, eating a very good piece of steak with Lorenzo, Frank and Dana recently. We know those conversations have kind of been going on. But, you know, GSP's a really good company guy. They would have had to be rock solid that he was going to sign with them to make that pronouncement sort of 3 or 4 weeks in advance, go through all those PR machinations and get the crew set up. That was a big logistical exercise they went through to get through that roster of names, get that red carpet. It was brilliantly set up, and my hat or my cap is doffed to the PR guys at UFC for another great job in terms of the visuals there. I think they would have done the deal with GSP. So yeah. I have to be honest, the most obscure rumor I saw, which was from the sort of internet anarchist Front Row Brian, was the CM Punk rumor, which has got a little bit of traction, but Brian's a loose cannon at the best of times, and he does like to mess around with people.
Brock v. CM Punk 2015, you heard it here first.
Yeah, indeed, and he's fighting Brock Lesnar, by the way.
Yeah,
with Fedora's special referee. So I'm at a bit of a loss, really. I still don't think it was Gina Carano either. Do you have a steer on where this thing was going?
I think it's one of two things. I think they're either going to announce a big stadium event in somewhere like Dallas. They wanted to do Cowboy Stadium before. I think that that's a possibility. One of the reasons why it might not be that is that you would want to announce a headline fight to go with it, and all of the top guys have already been placed. So it maybe isn't that. I think the most likely thing is part of what you mentioned earlier. I think it would be a big deal with a sports apparel company, someone like Under Armour or Adidas, and it will be a combination of a partnership deal with them and the launch of these new UFC uniforms, which if any eagle-eyed viewers of the UFC will have noticed in the preliminary fights of the previous UFC event, UFC 180, I think one or two of the prelim fights, the guys were pretty much wearing UFC uniform. Red shorts versus blue shorts, UFC branding. I think that was a bit of water testing going on there. I think that's the most likely. I think we're probably not far off the UFC announcing a major apparel deal with a big name brand, and it will involve the uniform, but it will probably also involve various other sports apparel as well. The UFC have always done their own themselves, you know, hoodies, t-shirts, all that sort of stuff, but to stick a Nike swoosh on it, or the 3 Adidas stripes, or even the Under Armour logo on it, it just takes it up a notch. It associates you with a major mainstream sports brand, and it's just another step towards pushing the UFC more into line with some of the other big sports. Reebok is another possibility. So I think that's probably the most likely one, and I think it's the sort of thing that they could have because I'm also looking at it as a sort of thing, is what sort of deal could they have been preparing to announce but not quite have got done in time? Couldn't really have been a fight, I don't think, unless they were bringing someone in from outside. And I think the Brock and GSP argument, we've already covered that. I think both of those were unlikely. So I think that's probably what it is. I think it's probably a sports apparel deal, possibly with the inclusion of the launch of the UFC uniforms. I suspect there's probably some I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed, and we may well see it announced in the new year. That's my best guess. So expect none of that to happen.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. Given your sort of predictions of late, by the time this podcast comes out, Joe Silva's probably announced McGregor and Rousey in a mixed tag against Chris Cyborg and Alistair Overeem, happening in Dallas Cowboys Stadium, and we'll all end up with egg on our faces. But it'll be fun, whatever it is.
This was our first crack at this. If you like what you heard, please do hit us up on Twitter and let us know what you like, what you didn't like. I'm at Simon Head. Ralph is at Ralph Welch MMA. Please do drop us a line and let us know. And if you've also got any questions for the next one, we're going to try and do these every week if we can, assuming our schedules will allow. So we'll hopefully have one next week. If you've got any questions between now and then, just drop us a line on Twitter and we'll note them down, and we'll put the five best ones in, and we'll talk our way through those on next week's show. That's pretty much it. Thanks for being on board, Ralph, and I'll speak to you again in a week's time.
Thanks very much, mate. Stay happy, stay healthy, and I'll see you at the fights.
Cheers. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. We'll speak soon.